Hey everyone, and welcome to Something Awesome. We are a podcast that likes to sit in the corner of nostalgic in you. And today we're definitely going to be on that nostalgic side, but also on the new side, technically.
Yeah.
Because it's new, and it's old.
Yeah. It's a new thing, semi-new thing, about an old thing.
Talking about an old thing.
Right.
Yeah. Pretty excited about this one. You brought this up to me.
Years ago,
actually, yeah. And I never really looked at it or read the book or anything.
So here's the funny thing is I read the book when it came out. I got it. So we're going to talk about Console Wars, yeah, by Blake Harris. Not necessarily by Blake Harris. We're going to talk about the documentary that's on Paramount Plus. So if you'd like to watch Console Wars, it's on Paramount Plus. Go check it out. It's worth the 2 hours of your life. It's fucking fantastic.
Not even 2 hours. It's like 2:32 or 1:32.
The book that originally came out was written by Blake Harris, and the way he wrote the book, I really kind of enjoyed, because he says, like, right up front, he's like, hey, this is an account of everything that happened during this period of time. And he said that, he even says, like, I took some creative license, not with facts, but with conversations. So some of these chapters may feel like it all happened at one time, but in actuality, they happened over the course of a few months and several different conversations. But it works together cohesively like this. So I put it like this for storytelling. Yeah. And Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg liked it so much that they bought the rights for film or film distribution and stuff like that. And originally they were supposed to make a movie about it.
Yeah.
Like an actual film. And then at one point it was going to be a TV show. And then it ended up just being
through a lot.
And then it ended up just being this documentary that they put on Paramount Plus. And there's some really interesting stuff in the documentary. Before we even get into that, I want to mention that and highly recommend if you care about that Nintendo versus Sega battle from the late 80s into the early and mid 90s, do yourself a favor and go read the book. It's so fantastically written and it's so well put together. All the research that Blake Harris did, all the quotes and stuff that he got that he turned into this story to make it a cohesive story, it's fantastic. So if you care about this at all, go read the book. It's great. But we're here to talk about the documentary.
Yeah, I watched this last night.
Yeah, fresh.
So yeah, it's fresh in my brain. Because I only have like 3 days left of Paramount Plus.
It's a good thing I reminded you.
Yeah, it's a good thing you reminded me. I got the deal last Black Friday.
Oh.
For like, I think it was half price.
Okay.
So I only paid $50 for it. For the year.
Yeah.
I watched this and... I'm familiar with the Console Wars. I mean, I was a kid back then.
What's that line? You're merely from the darkness. I was born in it. Yeah, we were born in it, man. That was the era we grew up.
Yeah.
We were at that perfect age for it.
Yeah, because I mean, definitely on the playground, you would hear like, "Oh, do you got Nintendo or Sega and all that stuff?" And,
oh, you got a Sega, boo!
Yeah, I was definitely a Nintendo household. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But when going into this, they did a good job of capturing both sides of Nintendo and Sega. Mm-hmm. But I definitely felt this was more Sega heavy.
Yeah.
Sega sided than Nintendo, which is fine. You know, like it didn't bother me. I'm just saying, like, I didn't think it was gonna be so Sega sided, but then once you realize what the story is about, mm-hmm, and like how it's going on, like, oh, so Sega's the little guy here. Sega's trying to do something different and be part of that competition of the home game console. Mm-hmm. And the trials that they had to go through in order to find that one launch mascot and separating Sega Japan and Sega America. Yeah, plus the animation in this, like the way they talk about the board meeting and the way they show this board meeting to visually, you know, entice you to watch it, like it's like a video game.
Yeah,
like you got this guy doing his presentation, like here's how I like this American guy saying, like, I know how to bring Sega to the States. I know how to do this.
The one frame of, like, the steam literally coming off the Sega Japan guy's head. Like,
yeah.
So it's like, damn, this is, like, the perfect way to do this.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah, the animation of this and, like, to make you feel invested into this story.
Yeah.
And into this documentary. They did a really good job of that. You know, and then, like, because, like, that first pitch, meaning that he was there, it was not going his way at all.
Right.
And he knew, like, he's like, this is it. My career is over. I'm done for. Like, and this guy had a track record, too, of, like, successful
rebuilding brands.
Yeah, there you go. Rebuilding brands. And, he thought this was over.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, the dramatization of it, of him going to the CEO guy going to the door. Like, oh, he's showing me the door. Yeah. Like, this is it. Like, you do what you got to do. And then he just leaves. Like, I love that. Like, the build up to that. Like, that's some good storytelling there.
And the chapter in the book is, dude, it's so much more in depth about it. It's so good. I'm probably going to say that a lot as we talk about this documentary, because, like I said, I love this documentary. I think it's really well done. And they really did a really fucking... It's not an adaptation, but they took the story from the book and translated it to this documentary almost perfectly. I think the best part about it is actually talking to all, like, Howard Lincoln and talking to all the people that were fucking there.
Yeah.
And I think the one takeaway from this documentary, and of course you can edit a documentary to say whatever you want to say, and I think it kind of feeds into the whole console wars aspect of it, but when they talk to the Nintendo people, they're still like, Sega makes games for Nintendo. They're in a relationship with Nintendo where every so often they make Mario and Sonic crossover video games. Like, they have a fucking relationship. But even to this day, the tone in the Nintendo people's voices is still like, fuck Sega. Like, it's ridiculous. And then, like, the tone from the Sega people's side is like, yeah, we totally fucked over Nintendo. It was great. Like, it's still, that rivalry still exists. They were in a fucking business relationship to this day where not only do Sega games get released on Nintendo consoles and have for almost 20 years at this point, but they had their mascots do fucking Olympics games together every 4 years, but they're still like, man, fuck those Sega people. And fuck those Nintendo people. And I thought that was really, really funny, because in the book, you don't really get a sense of that, because, again, Blake Harris is writing it almost like a linear story. So you're getting quotes and conversations, but they're not presented as quotes and conversations. They're presented as, this is the story. So seeing the actual people from that era still like, yeah, that was an underhanded tactic, but hey, what are you going to do about it? Like, it's really cool to see that rivalry still is there.
Yeah. And then you saw it with the ads, too.
Yeah.
They talked about how, like, can we actually call them out? Like, they weren't sure if they could actually call them out with, like, colors.
Yeah.
And
their phony blast processing marketing.
Oh, yeah. The blast. It's totally turbo fucking blasting.
Fake.
Yeah.
Totally fake. It's hilarious.
That was fucking funny, dude. Like, I remember hearing that about the turbo blast
processing. Yeah, blast processing.
That was good. Like, nobody knew you were, like, it wasn't a thing. Like, it was just marketing.
And the funny thing is, I remember being a kid and having these conversations on the playground with people. It's like, oh, the Genesis is better than the Super Nintendo because it has blast processing. It's like, this wasn't a fucking... We were idiots. We totally bought into it. Hook, line, and sinker. Well, that's why Mortal Kombat is better on Genesis, because of blast processing. No. It's still better on Super Nintendo. It just doesn't have the blood.
Yeah.
But
that was one of the things too with Mortal Kombat. Like, I don't remember that too well.
Oh,
because
I do.
Like, I played Mortal Kombat in the arcade. I never played it on console.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know that they changed the blood to green.
Yeah.
That was new to me. And then I think the only time I did play Mortal Kombat on console was on the Sega.
Okay.
Just because friend had the Sega.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a huge deal. I remember, like, I was so happy that they talked about Mortal Kombat as in depth as they did in this thing, mm-hmm. because that really was like a tide turner for Genesis. That really was like,
yeah.
ours has the book. Yeah, you got to enter a code because for rating purposes, we can't have it out of the gate. You just enter a code and it's there. And I think that was genius. The other thing that they really didn't talk about too much that I wish they would have talked about a little bit more is that they did mention how Tom Kalinske said, I want to rebrand the Genesis when Sonic comes out and I want to put Sonic in the box.
Yeah.
And they were like, are you fucking kidding me? That's where all our revenue comes from, selling the games, not from selling the console. We're going to lose money. But what they did when they did that was they forced Nintendo's hand to put, because Nintendo was not going to put Super Mario World in the box mm-hmm. when you bought a Super Nintendo. That was not part of the plan. But Sega kept throwing shit out like, we're going to put Sonic in the box. We're going to rebrand it. We're going to drop it $100. We're putting Sonic in the fucking box. Let's go. Nintendo had no choice but to put Mario in the box. And I think it's a crazy story. And they go so in depth about that in the book. And they kind of touch on it a little bit in this documentary. But there's so much stuff that I knew a lot of it was going to kind of like hit the cutting room floor, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Or however you'd want to frame that documentary. It was going to hit the floor. But yeah, man, that was a gamble for Sega. Because yeah, that's how they made money, was by software sales, not by console sales. The console sales number was just like a fucking vanity thing. We sold more consoles than Nintendo this month. Hell yeah. But it didn't matter because that's not where they were making money. They were making money in software sales and game adoption rate. And that's still the case to this day. Most consoles don't make any money on the console sale. They make the platform holders make the money on the cut they get from software sales. And to throw what you think is going to be your biggest game in the box is a fucking gamble because you're losing out on that revenue.
Yeah, which is kind of weird to hear because like today you kind of get that now. Like you'll get a PlayStation with, you know, The Last of Us thrown in there. But
it's,
when you think about it, it's not really until after.
But it's a year. Yeah, it's a year and a half after the game was out.
Yeah.
Grand Theft Auto on PlayStation 4, when they did that version of it, that's when I got a PlayStation 4. The year after. And that was in the box, and that came with Last of Us Remastered and mm-hmm. Grand Theft Auto 5. And yes, that used to be a thing. Well, it wasn't a thing, and then Sega made it a thing, but then nobody else kind of jumped on that bandwagon. Like nobody else was putting games in the box. Like I remember, unless you waited, like you said, a year to get the console and it came with a game, which is kind of like, we've talked about this before on the old podcast, and I think I brought it up when we did our history of video gaming episode. Like with the rare exception of maybe two things, I've never gotten a console at launch. I've always got it a year later when I had a game bundled in or there was a price drop. And that was the way it was. But and Genesis was already out. And then they rebranded it and reintroduced it to the world with Sonic in the box and a cheaper price tag. So that's the same year that the SNES came out, because that wasn't out yet. Genesis was out first. And I think that's something that kind of people forget. Like, we always remember Master System and Nintendo launched at the same time. Genesis and Super Nintendo launched at the same time. Nah, they didn't, man. They were separated. And
yeah, I forget that too, like how much time and year between the two consoles being released.
Yeah.
That was a big game changer, putting that game into that system for sure. Sega definitely gave them a run for their money for a good while.
And I really feel like it would have continued to happen if Japan didn't get their ego bruised by
Sega
of America doing well.
Yeah.
It didn't, like reading the book, like you know the story and what happened, but reading the book, it's like, yeah, this isn't shocking at all. That's the culture. Like they were embarrassed by an outsider who took their dying brand and made it a big thing. And now it's like, well, we don't fucking need him anymore. Let's do the way we want to now. And then what happened? Sega Saturn failed. Sega Dreamcast failed. Sega now just makes video games. They don't make a console anymore.
Dreamcast was their last one, right?
Yeah.
And that was in 97?
No. 99.
9999, I think, was one of those. Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
September 9th, 1999.
Wow. Yeah. And then here comes Nintendo later on to
say. Yeah, basically. And what's crazy is, like, a lot of people thought that the Xbox was going to fail out of the gate, because a lot of people that were part of the Xbox development were the people that were part of the Dreamcast development.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, but then they realized when the Xbox came out, oh, this was the fucking Sega of Japan's problem, not the hardware manufacturers and the hardware developers.
Yeah.
The Xbox took off right away. I mean, it didn't sell. The original Xbox didn't sell a fraction of what a PS2 had already sold in the market in that 2 years or whatever before it came out. But it was a hit right out of the gate. The Xbox was a fucking hit. And then it just kept steamrolling with the 360. And then they had their misstep with the Xbox One. And they even say, like, we picked the wrong generation to fail. Because that was the PS4 and Xbox One generation was the first generation where people really, really latched onto digital. So anybody that was on a PS4, there's no way they were going to move back to Xbox with the new consoles that are out now, because they bought all their digital games on a PS4. And that was, like, really the embracing of the digital culture by a wider audience. But yeah, it's a really cool story, man. It's a fucking really well done documentary. Like you were saying, all the animations, the music was so well done. Music is
good too. Yeah.
Last year I talked about the YouTube channel, The Gaming Historian.
Yeah.
And that's what this reminded me of. Like, that dude does really nice, polished documentaries, and there's some really long ones. There's one about Mario Brothers 3 that's really long and really well done. There's one about Mario Kart. And he goes and he tries to get quotes from people, and he does, like, he's used animations in the past, but not like this. Like, it's black and white line drawings and stuff, but it's really well done. But this reminded me of that. Like, this was kind of put together similarly to the way Gaming Historian puts together his stuff. And it's not like they stole his style or anything, because all he does is basic storytelling documentaries about things, retrospectives about stuff. But that's what this felt like. So if you guys are into video game history, check out The Gaming Historian on YouTube, because his stuff is really, really good. It's second to none in that field.
Yeah. One of my favorite parts about the or what I thought was kind of funny of this documentary was the part where, I don't remember her name, but her and, like, someone else went around, like, the different malls, going off the difference, like, because they wanted to make sure more hands got on the Sega. And then went around to different malls to
and they were running Nintendo, the games side by side.
Yeah, right. Putting both together, and a lot of people were like, "Yeah, like, Sega's actually, you know, has better graphics, blah blah." And then she talked about how she's like, she got excited because she got to put on the Sonic suit.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah, like, oh yeah, I was expecting to get, like, hugs and handshakes, but, like, these teens were just aggressive. Like, so, like, that kind of actually helped them figure out how to market it too.
Yeah.
As well, because, like, they were looking for high fives and, like, fist bumps and things like that, like, very aggressive about
it. So,
like,
Poochie syndrome. It's what it is, man.
And so then they kind of, like, catered to that. So they kind of shifted their marketing to that, like, with Sonic, you know, being, like, moves so fast and everything. Like, and then they also mentioned, like, what do they call it? Like, with the rings. Giving them, like, that dopamine ring sound from like those Japanese arcades.
Dude, there's, like, if,
which is so true, because I remember playing and loving hearing all those, like, ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, it was the same as getting coins in Mario, except you didn't get them as often as you do in Sonic.
Yeah.
There's gas stations that I'll go to that when they scan items, the cash register makes the fucking Sonic ring noise, and, like, it literally synapses start fucking firing, and I'm like, oh, yeah. Like, and I wasn't a big Sega guy. I had a Master System, which I talked about on the our History and Gaming episode. Go back and check that out from last season. But yeah, I had a Sega Master System, but after that, like, I was Nintendo until I got a PS2. Like, So I didn't stick with Sega. I had a Master System, and I had a Sega Saturn at one point, which I really enjoyed, but there just wasn't enough games for the Sega Saturn to make it a viable platform. Because they were, it was an in-between console, because they were already working on the Dreamcast. And I just never had a Dreamcast. But yeah, like, I wasn't necessarily a Sega guy. I was kind of gaming agnostic for a little while. For a long while, actually. Until, like, PS2, PS3... But even then, I had a 360 and a PS3. I have a Series S and a PS5 and a Nintendo Switch. Like, I'm all over the place. Like, I don't have allegiance to one place. But if I was ever going to say, like, oh, that's home team, I would say Nintendo, because I had an NES for, like, 12 years that I played. Fucking going all the way into, like, I got one... And I think I said, I told you, 86 maybe was when I got mine. 87. Yeah, it's 87, because I was 5 years old. So I was in kindergarten when we got our Nintendo. And I had that all the way up until, I still fucking have it to this day. But it was plugged into my TV all the way up until I got an N64 in 97, which I got an N64 a year later after it came out. But yeah, like I guess I would say Nintendo is home team, but they did a lot of shit in that era that was, I wouldn't call it unethical, but it was fucking borderline, man. Like,
they're a little shady.
It was borderline unethical.
Yeah, because they kind of talked about that too, how they made certain deals with certain brands, department stores and stuff. Like, you're only going to be carrying this. You can't carry anything else. Yeah, which is kind of turning into a monopoly, which they also mentioned too.
Right.
A big part of that. And even, I think today, even sometimes they get kind of shit for that too. With some of the...
It's definitely better now than it was then.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, man. They get the big fucking end caps. They still get the big fucking end caps. Like, the Switch is so fucking outdated at this point. But when you walk into a Target... You don't, like, the first thing you see is when you go to the electronics area is not a PlayStation logo or an Xbox logo. It's a big fucking Nintendo end cap. Like, they still get that preferential treatment because they've been around the longest. Well deserved, by the way. I'm not knocking it. Like, well deserved. It's just, it's crazy to see how that things have changed, but they're still the same. Like, yeah. They're still the same.
They found new ways
to
work the system, basically.
Yeah. Talking about the Monopoly thing, I think it's, imagine the fucking balls you have to go, all right, you're not going to fucking put us in your stores. We're going to open a store right across the street from your fucking headquarters and show you how many units we move.
Yeah. Yeah, they did that. And they talked about all the billboards too. Like, just like they bought every billboard.
Which is near the, like, what do you say, like a 15 or 20 mile radius of the headquarters? Yeah.
Fucking genius.
So cool. Like, where do you get that, the balls to do something like that? Like, where do you think, like, oh, this will work? This is a great idea. Like, paying rent, a lease on a retail space and selling your stuff. Granted, they weren't having to pay. They didn't have to pay for to sell. They were, all that profit was theirs. They didn't have to split it with another company, but you don't get mainstream mass market penetration without being in a mainstream mass market store. And that's what they needed. And yeah, that was, I remember walking into, even in the Super Nintendo era, like go into Target and they had the big Nintendo kiosk where you could fucking push the buttons and it would play a trailer for a game, or you could try a demo of a game.
I remember going to Montgomery Ward's.
Fuck yeah, dude. I know.
there was a whole setup
there. I know exactly which one you're talking about, because that's that the one I used to go to also.
They have the whole setup. Vaguely pointed
in its direction from where we're sitting, by the way.
They have a whole setup on like Nintendo. That's where I bought my Game Boy.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't buy it. My parents bought it first. But
I got mine. This is a fucking thing. I got my Game Boy at Fedco. You remember Fedco?
Fedco.
Oh, in Cerritos? No. It was like a really cool store. It was an actual fucking department store. And my grandmother got discounts there. It was a union store. And she got discounts there because she was in the United Auto Workers Union. She worked at McDonnell Douglas, which is now Boeing,
right,
in Long Beach. So we used to go there and shop all the time because it was a union store. But yeah, it was. That's where I got my Game Boy. That's where I got my N64. That's where I bought my first DVD. Was at Fedco. Right, was right before it closed. Like, yeah, they went out of business. But yeah, man, like, just going in and seeing that, and then never seeing, that was part of the deal. It was like, okay, you can carry stuff, but you don't give anybody a display like this where they get to look at video games, trailers, or play demos.
Test them out.
I remember Sears.
Sears was another big one, too. That had
Sears right here, by the way. You know which one I'm talking about. At the mall. That's where I first played a Game Gear, because in their electronics section, they had like one of the fucking arms with the Game Gear stuck to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all they had. Nintendo still had the big fucking displays and everything, and all Sega had was this little
tucked away place,
Game Gear. And that's where I first played a Game Gear, and that's where I was like, I need this. Is Grandma, look, this is in color. it takes fucking 6 batteries, and I didn't know this yet. They only last for 2 hours. But it's in color.
I remember worst battery life.
Because there's a TV tuner. You can watch TV on this thing.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
I never had the TV tuner, but I tried my damnedest to get one. I had the Game Gear, though. That was good enough. But yeah, man, like, retail space was crazy at the time. And that was like going even to fucking 96, 97, with, you know, when PlayStation entered the market. PlayStation.
Which I like how they talked about that too.
PlayStation was the first other platform besides Nintendo, because I still never remember seeing any like kiosk at a Target with a Sega thing on it until the Dreamcast had a thing. But before that, it was Nintendo and PlayStation. Like, Sony completely like booted Sega into a distant third when the PlayStation came out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was crazy to see that they were, because they could get the retail space, Sony could, because, well,
they make,
you're not gonna, you don't want to carry our video game consoles, well, then you don't get our TVs, you don't get our stereos,
exactly,
you don't get our headphones, you don't get our movies, you don't get our record label stuff. Like, they had power in the retail space, in the electronics retail space, so they could get the big box stores to okay them having a kiosk with a game. And yeah, that's how I fucking first played Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, was on a Target. No, it was a Kmart PlayStation. But yeah, it was really cool going back. Even though I read the book recently within the last 5 years or so, like, no, 5 years is shit. Time's weird. It's going by fast. I was talking about this last night. This year has gone by so fucking slow, but at the same time, I'm like, this year went by way too quickly.
We're in December.
Yeah. But yeah, man, like, it's when I first read the book, it really reminded me of that era, and like going to Target and seeing all the Nintendo stuff, and like the fucking one shelf, the 2-foot space that Sega had, and that's what they had to deal with, and that's what they had to work from, and they still managed to start to edge out Nintendo in that 16-bit era.
Yeah, exactly that. I remember seeing that too. Like they just started getting smaller and smaller in space, and then eventually they disappeared.
Yeah. That dude Tom Kalinske, I think it's pretty cool that he's getting some shine now, and I wonder how he feels about the Barbie franchise now. Because they just had a fucking $1 billion movie come out.
Yeah.
And if Mattel doesn't hire him in the 80s, there is no fucking Barbie. Because Barbie was a dead brand. And that's legit. Look it up. Like, that's not just this guy patting himself on the back. Barbie was a dead brand, and he came in and fucking turned that shit around and made it the major brand that it became again. And that's why Sega hired him. They're like, well, if he could turn around Barbie, which was literally on its last legs, maybe he can help us. And it's pretty cool, that story, when he talks about the Sega guy coming. He was on vacation with his family, and this guy.
Oh, yeah.
That's real. That's fucking real. That's not like a fake thing they made up because it sounds cool. That's fucking real.
His kid's like, he came all the way from Japan, Dad.
You gotta at least go listen. But yeah, and the way they tell it, the way Blake Harris writes it in the book, is so well done. And like, the aspect about him staying in that hotel.
Oh, the Comfort Inn.
The Comfort Inn, yeah. And like
that's why that hotel?
And the guy from Japan is like, this place is great. Yeah. No, it's not. It's a fucking Comfort Inn.
No one wants to stay at a Comfort Inn.
But yeah, it was, oh man, it's so cool. I love this story. I think the quote unquote console war shit, fanboy stuff got out of hand in the PS2, GameCube, Xbox era, and then into the Xbox 360, PS3 era. I think it got way out of hand, but the aspect of it that I do enjoy learning about is the business side. And like, what was going through these people's minds when they decided to fucking make Sonic have so much attitude if you left him idle, tapping his fucking foot, like, come on, let's go. Like, Sega does what Nintendo don't. The Crash Bandicoot ads where he's standing outside amazing. Of the I Nintendo. Love the
Crash ads.
Yeah. Like, and that was just riffing off of what Sega did. Like, but coming Sega proved that it could work. Yeah. And that proved that it could, Sega proved that that could work, that style of
marketing.
There's this, like, there's this bullshit that goes around in everything where it's like, oh, you can punch up, but don't punch down. So like, Nintendo wouldn't, they were the big dog, so they would never make ads like that targeting Sega or Sony. But in my opinion, the minute you start swinging on someone, they're perfectly within their right to swing back. I wish Nintendo would have went and been like, fuck you and your blast processing, that shit ain't even real. You're lying to these people. Like, that would have been great. But, you know, Nintendo was up here, so they wouldn't. Nintendo's not that kind of company. They don't punch down or whatever. They don't punch at all. They just continue on their path and do their thing. And
they're like the company that won't sink down to that level because they have like honor.
Yeah, they're still around. It's over 100 years. They made trading cards. They were before they were into video games, they were a toy company. Like, it's crazy to see how far they've come. So this, watching this documentary made me want to read the book again, which I think I'm going to do. But it also made me want to read and watch 8-Bit Christmas again. Because
I got to watch that.
You haven't watched that yet?
I haven't watched it yet.
Oh, that could be a good episode.
That could be the next one.
Yeah. You should also read the book. The book is fun. But I want to read that again because the reason I got... here's something else you'd like on Kindle was because I bought Console Wars and read it. And then it was like, here's other books that might interest you. And 8-Bit Christmas was that one of those other books. And I was like, oh, cool. Let me check this out. Oh, it's only $2.99. It's a Kindle single. Cool. And then I find out they're going to make a movie about it. And the guy was a script writer. And this was an idea he had pitched, but nobody bid on it. So he wrote it as a book to prove it could work, and it sold a lot of copies on Kindle, and that ended up getting it sold as a movie. And actually did pretty well on HBO Max, if I'm not mistaken. Max now. But yeah, this made me want to relive that era a little bit. And I do have my Nintendo, but I don't have a TV I can fucking plug it into, because none of the TVs I have have composite cables on the back
anymore. This one has it, I think. I think it does.
Bring my Nintendo over. That'd be fucking sick. But yeah, I have my Nintendo. Still my original Nintendo in games from 1987, which is fucking dope. And I still have that.
I wish I still had that old
I wonder if it I don't even know still where works. It would be. I don't even know if this thing still fucking works because I haven't plugged it in. So
yeah. The oldest console I have right now is my PS3.
Yeah,
which doesn't even work.
My Master System is still in my grandparents' house, but that thing's been dead for a long
time. Hmm.
Something on the board internally that fried because it doesn't accept. Like, there's no power to it when I plug it in. Nothing wrong with the adapter. It's something on the board, which is a bummer. But yeah, man, that's
console wars.
Yeah, I really do want to. So I think what I'll end up doing now is having the Switch is to relive some of those games, is play a bunch of those games that are on the NES, online, the Nintendo Online shit. Because they have Genesis games on there too now, on the Nintendo Online service. So maybe I'll play some of those.
I haven't been on my Switch in forever.
I've been keeping up with the Mario Kart DLC stuff.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Because my kids like to lose a lot in Mario Kart. So every time a new track comes out, they're like, "Dad, let's play Mario Kart." And I'm like, "You mean you're going to pick the track you want to lose on? Okay, let's go." So yeah, we do that periodically. Family Mario Kart nights. All of us play. We all have Nintendo Switches. We all play together.
Awesome.
But yeah, I think I want to go back and relive some of that nostalgia and play some of those old games that kind of, like, especially with Sega, like, they have Sonic on there. That shit, that turned the tide. I even bought on Switch the, how was it called? Sonic Collection, they have like a bundle something. Or something. Yeah, yeah, they had a game that had like 50 like Sega Genesis games
put together. Yeah,
yeah, like a collection. And the wrapping around it was pretty cool because you're like in a room and you pick games off of a shelf and it puts it in the thing.
Oh, that's awesome!
It's really fucking cool. Yeah, I'll show you that next time. But yeah, man, it was really cool to go through this story again because I haven't really thought about it since reading the book, and then I totally forgot that the documentary was a thing until somebody in the 616 Entertainment Discord posted like, "Oh, hey, check this out. This documentary is on YouTube if you guys want to watch it." And I was like, "Console Wars?" And I was like, and I watched the trailer and I was like, "Wait, it became a documentary?" I was like, "Are they still doing a movie?" And then I was like, I had to do research. I was like, "Oh, this is what it turned into." They ended up pivoting and doing something different.
Yeah, so many different levels of a movie, show, and a doc.
Which is crazy because I think this could be a really fucking good TV show.
This could be a good TV show.
And you could go further. You don't have to stop where the documentary and the book stops. You can go into the actual life of the PlayStation and the actual demise of Sega and the re-rise of Nintendo. Like, this could be a really good long-running television show. Shit, man. Evan Goldberg and Seth Rogen even wrote the forward to the book, like,
yeah.
So it's just crazy, like, that they got on it right away to where they have a forward in the book, then they were gonna make a movie, then the TV show, then the documentary. Like, it's crazy and all over the place, but it's such a cool story. And if you didn't live it, this is the best way to experience it.
Learn about it
through this book and through this documentary, because even though we lived it, there's so much information in here that I didn't know.
Yeah, there was a lot I didn't know. I mean, yeah, we lived it, but like, we didn't know the backstory of all this.
We were little kids fighting over blast processing and the fucking, what the fuck was the Super Nintendo one? They had a chip on theirs too, like an actual one.
I don't know.
I feel like an idiot because I can't remember. But it helped with like the 3D, faux 3D and side scrolling stuff. Like, that game Uniracers. Did you ever play Uniracers? It's just a unicycle. They're unicycles on a track, but they can rotate around the track. So yes. It's just 2D, but it does like faux 3D because of the chip that's in the Super Nintendo.
I don't remember. Yeah, yeah.
It's so good. Really cool stuff. Really good information in this document.
Yeah.
I'm glad you liked it. I knew you would.
It was informative, yeah.
Yeah.
Marketing is definitely something that I like to learn about.
Yeah.
How, you know, because that's really what it all, like, that's how you get shit to sold is through the marketing. I mean, and yeah, the turbo blast processor, that had me laughing for like a good 5 minutes while watching it.
Like, and then they show like in that in the malls, like, why is Sega better than Nintendo? Oh, it's got blast processing. It's like these little kids that are like latching on to that marketing term. It has blast processing.
I should be in marketing.
How does Sonic move so fast? Oh, it's the blast processing. Oh my god, it's so fucking hilarious.
I guess that's gonna be it for this week.
Yeah, yeah, that'll do it, man.
So yeah, check it out. Paramount Plus, get a free trial.
And I'm actually gonna remember to send Rick like a picture of the book's cover art so he can put it in here when we talk about it.
I think I already have it. I think I still have it
from because I think it was on my books list too.
It was, yeah. I'll definitely put it there.
Yeah.
But yeah, thanks for joining us on this new/nostalgic corner because that's kind of what this was.
This is like the perfect intersection.
Yeah, exactly. yeah, thanks for watching. Also, thanks of course to the wonderful person who created our music.
Yeah, Nigel Bravo, Stoke Crow Comedy on Bandcamp and on Twitch. Go check out his streams. He's a fucking cool dude.
The creator of music, like, he made this for us.
It's a royalty-free album he made specifically for this reason.
Yeah, because then we can play this music. Thanks again, and be sure to subscribe, all that good stuff down below. You'll see it there. And we'll catch you next time.
Yeah, peace.